My name is Ed Piskor.
I'm Jim Rugg.
We're going to be talking about chapters 5 through 8 of Alan Moore and Eddie Campbell's From Hell, Jack the Ripper masterpiece, but first a little business.
Octobriana, 1976, my latest comic, the world's first blacklight comic, printed with fluorescent ink, featuring the underground Russian superhero Octobriana trying to save the world against robot Stalin and his latest doomsday device. This is in comic stores everywhere right now. Get it wherever you get comics. Get it quickly because it is selling better than I expected. Thank you all very much, but it's going quick. So if you want this unique comic in your collection, grab it as soon as you get a chance.
Pittsburghers, I saw these copies, versions of Phantom of the Attic. Get them while they're hot. They're not there anymore, I bet you.
Variants. They are about gone.
Patreon.com/Ed Piskor is where I'm serializing my current project, Red Room, for the early adopters. $3 will get you the complete archive, and the images are up there at a high enough resolution that people have been sending me their bootlegs, Jimmy. Every Tuesday, new strips go live, and issue 1, as of this recording, is almost completely up there.
By the way, if you all love From Hell, check out Red Room.
So where we left off, Jimmy, in our last video, there wasn't even one murder.
No. Well, we're going to make up for some lost time and cover, I don't know, 4 of them in these next 4 chapters?
Yes. Dude, I went to the comic shop just yesterday, pick up some stuff, and I saw a copy of From Hell there. I was kind of curious what the color version was like, and they didn't have a copy there. But they had, you know, this is a perennial. You keep this on your store shelves. The newer printings are so white on, like, archival paper. It doesn't work as well to me. Like, this is the one that you want.
You're not kidding. Format-wise, when they made this decision to put it on this newsprint, that was talked about a little bit. That was a design decision, and I think a very flattering one for this material, because Eddie Campbell's art looks like it's of that time period. It looks like the etchings. You know, I think that's not accidental. I think that was definitely a creative choice he made. And you put it on this kind of pulpy paper, it really flatters it. There is an edition where the edges of the pages are black. This was a very limited version. I've never seen it in person, but it sounds like that might be a pretty good treatment as well.
Like a color blocking?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Just like, this like dark, Death Note. Yeah, exactly. Just sooty kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think that would also fit the material well, but I like this newsprint treatment. You know, Kitchen Sink did versions of this. It was done in Taboo originally. Very nice paper and reproduction, but something fits with this. This feels gross even when you touch it with your hands. It feels like you should have to have like the black ink on your fingers like old newspapers.
Right.
After you read this.
So let's talk about soot and grit and get into chapter 5. This is the one that has this kind of juxtaposition of the ink wash and the black and white line.
Before you get there, what we're seeing here, conception of Adolf Hitler.
Is that what we're looking at?
This is his parents, you know, having sex about the time that he would have been conceived, which was one of the many conceits of this book, was looking at what are the ramifications of this event, how did it shape 20th century, and that's one of the connections Alan Moore makes, is the whole idea of Hitler being conceived around the time period of this happening, which may be a stretch, but interesting from a storytelling point of view. And so that's what these first couple pages are. And then we do get into the comparisons between Dr. Gall and his kind of upper class lifestyle with those ink washes compared to the prostitutes who, this is amazing. You know, like they would pay their couple of pennies or whatever to stay at this place overnight where you were tied up to the wall. You sat sleeping up, tied to the wall so you wouldn't just fall down on the floor. Cost almost nothing, but this would have been like your impoverished life. And it made me think, like, are these characters homeless for the most part?
They, whenever you watch these documentaries and stuff about the Whitechapel killings, they always talk about the way life was for these girls. Every day they start from zero, and throughout the day you need your like $4 to have the privilege to stay at this place. So by any means necessary, if on a good day you just rob for that $4, on a bad day you got to fuck some creeps, you know. And but that was
and hope you don't get robbed.
Exactly. And that was day in, day out.
Yeah, it's he paints that picture very effectively, like these lives of the lower class people, men and women that are depicted, just brutal. And yeah, that includes like Aberline, the detective, who has to go back to Whitechapel and does some, just continues to paint this picture, right? Like, this is a bleak, dark place, Whitechapel, at this time period.
Yeah. Cool storytelling stuff where we have these kind of like more elongated panels for the William Gall sections, and then the skinny, narrow third section is relegated for the prostitute who's just doing what she can to get a couple of shillings.
Dude, page architecture as an expression of her, you know, less than existence.
Right.
Man.
This piece right here, man, it's just a line for the for Gull's like petticoat, and you just see that hand. Perfect. Got our little cup of coffee with the Elephant Man.
Yeah, it's weird that relationship. I think that's what, you know, there are a lot of these. What I admire from this book, rereading it, is how many threads Moore is weaving.
Sure.
With, we see detectives and kind of them doing their work, both good and bad police work. We see the journalists who are doing, you know, new journalism and stuff. There's so many of these different pieces that he's weaving together in here. And I think that's what the Elephant Man stuff is. You know, it's one more piece of this time period that he's painting, the setting that he's creating. And weirdly, the Elephant Man is part of that setting, part of the oddity.
So one of Alan Moore's conceits is this grand conspiracy by way of the crown. And it goes to the Masons, man, the brother Masons. So William Gall is letting Scotland Yard know, because one of the main guys at Scotland Yard is a brother Mason. And he's just like, listen, man, I was ordered by the Queen to kill 4 motherfuckers, man. So you just got to look the other way. And there's some tribulation. There's some bullshit that goes along with this, man. But ultimately, our Scotland Yard, whatever you would call that guy, the Commissioner Gordon of that stuff, is like, okay, I'll just make sure they're just like a real shitty cop.
Yeah, the conspiracy part is great. Like this whole story is full of that Mason, the Masonry connections behind this. And I think he does that conspiracy thing really well with the police, because he interacts with this guy's chief of police or whatever that position would be at the top of the line. It's very disturbing that the story that Moore is telling here.
Right.
And showing those threads of like, well, how do you get away with this? And it's like connections. It's all these upper level people have these connections to each other.
When you see Netley, you know there's trouble ahead, man. He's the Igor to the Dr. Frankenstein that is Sir William Gall.
There's going to be a few call outs to the great Eddie Campbell throughout these 4 chapters. This row of seeing the through the glass, it's not a reflection, but the distortion through the glass. Incredible.
Yes.
Right? Incredible. And, you know, that's Polly. That's going to be our first victim. And she emerges from behind that glass in some really impressive drawing.
William Gall gets ready for he kisses his wife goodnight when he has to go out on the town to go do some business, man.
Yeah, spends his day looking at, like, Egyptian artifacts, kissing his wife, having nice dinners, shaving, and then heading out to kill prostitutes.
Yeah. So one of the things that Netley was tasked with, you got to give this girl a piece of flair.
We need to find her,
yeah.
Mark her somehow.
Yeah. So just like, you know, when Bubbles in The Wire is giving the important drug dealers the red hat, got to give this lady a bonnet.
You know what? I'm glad you mentioned The Wire. I felt that several times reading this. We'll point out a couple more as we go through these chapters, but that's great.
Look at that sooty sky.
I love it.
You almost can't breathe. That's what our homies are dealing with on the West Coast, because somebody, a couple had to have a gender reveal party and burn up half the fucking country.
He's poisoning grapes. That's what we're seeing on these pages.
Yeah.
Grapes that he's going to feed to his victims once he picks up Polly. I guess they're a sedative?
It's that laudanum stuff, which would have been the anesthetic of the day to put your ass out whenever surgery was required.
There's a couple of moments like this, too. This is like fire engulfing, you know, kind of her world. We saw at a panel a couple pages earlier, there was a background that was like that. We're going to see a few of these examples where, like, the world, the present world drops away and we see other stuff. Visions, time sort of displacement visions, but it's an interesting choice visually.
Yeah.
You know, it creates a mood. And again, man, all these night scenes, the coaches, the amount of black ink on these pages that still reads, it is such a dark dark story, right. Literally.
Right. Pages of pages. This is at the beginning of Inglourious Basterds when the German officer is there in the house and we see the people underneath the floorboards. We know what's happening. This is the Jack the Ripper comic. Page after page after page of conversation between the two. It's making you feel for the girl. You know, it's making you, it's turning her into a person for us just before the inevitable, but not before they drive by the Elephant Man.
Yeah, and he makes her give a salutation as if it was the Indian god that she's talking to. It's such a creepiness that Moore evokes with this language stuff. We laughed about Netley being made sick as he starts to see the bigger picture, but I felt some of that dread reading this stuff.
For sure.
You know, like there's such setups to what you know are inevitable, gruesome endings. These characters are so pathetic in so many ways, and to just read pages of Gull's setup, it's really disturbing.
Yeah. There's this weird piece, and I'm sure he touches on it in the appendix, where he makes Netley more kind of complicit in the action, you know, take a swipe or something. Could this be, you know, when they find the body in real life, like there's like one cut that seems amateurish, but all the other ones are surgically perfect. So Alan Moore's just building that into his narrative. Because, dude, when you read the appendix, which I only glanced over whenever I would have like maybe a little trouble reading a thing, I'll read the appendix. And the amount of people walking out of bars is corroborated in books that he read, you know, and these people are incidental. Like these people are for witness play a little bit later. But it's as accurate as possible down to those degrees.
I was going to ask you about the appendix. I actually run two bookmarks in my book so that I can flip between appendix and foreground for that exact reason. It's so extensive and it's revealing like what information exists and where it comes from.
Right.
That's really cool about Netley making that cut. I didn't make that connection, but that is why you would put it in there, because it's like there's a record of this odd cut. How would you explain this with right. Gull? And like it is explained. It's fascinating to read the appendix and go back and forth, because all those pieces, and again, this is the mine hunter, you know,
right.
With I just picture Alan Moore having all these threads connecting everything and then like adding the fictional scenes, you know, in between. And there aren't that many, like it's rare, but he'll note whenever something's completely fabricated. But it is fascinating as a storytelling thing to kind of like go back and forth between those notes and see where this stuff is coming from. And I would be wrong if I guessed which parts I think are made up and which parts are accurate, or at least historically recorded.
Sure. Except for when Sir William Gull is in modern day and there's a skyscraper and he's looking at that. I think you would be right about that.
I would guess that one. Yeah, I'd figure that one out.
I mean, we could keep going on with this first chapter, but basically first body's discovered. And the entire scene is kind of run over, you know, like, once again, The Wire, if you read that the book that inspired The Wire, they talk about the crucial like first day where you need to collect evidence, because the evidence, you know, just your regular patrolman is going to step on important things and all that. Like we're witness to that throughout this whole series.
Yeah, the pieces are really incredible, and it speaks to the whole way this story is put together. It's almost like, I don't know, 85% of these pieces Moore has pulled from reference material.
Right.
And if you lay those out chronologically and where they overlap, and then he plugs in the little extra interstitial pieces you need to just kind of make this fit, it's the wildest story to read in that regard, because of what he's pulling from in terms of reference. And then it's like, I remember reading this the first time and being like, oh, clearly that's Jack the Ripper. And that's not exactly what Moore is saying, but it's so convincing.
Right. That chapter ends with Sir William Gull kissing his old lady who's sleeping cozy in bed. And look at how, in that middle panel, how pleased he is with himself while he's laying there.
That's another fun thing not to gloss over, is that drawing style. Mm-hmm. Is putting the washes in here. Because we talked about that linen paper earlier. I haven't seen that for a couple of chapters.
Right.
But you see Campbell, you know, making a giant 500-page graphic novel and yet still being able to experiment visually.
Chapter 6 is where we introduce our inspector guy. He escaped Whitechapel for a while, hoping to just keep going up the ladder. He was working Scotland Yard for a little while, but guess what, man? You're going back. And why is he going back? All chips are against him. There are other Brother Masons who are going to be tasked with running the Whitechapel cases, but they know the deal. They know exactly what's happening. One guy takes a powder, is going to straight up Switzerland. Neutral territory, man. He's getting the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
And then...
And bad-mouthing the investigators on his way out the door, saying that he probably could have solved this case in a couple of days if he had been around.
Right.
Yeah, it is. All the chips are stacked against him. Again, you know, this is stuff that Moore's pulling from some of this reference, where it's like, not only is this unsolved, but all these different pieces make it look like it wasn't supposed to be solved. I would draw attention to, like, these middle panels for several of these pages where we see, like, the victim, we see the victim's file. A lot of emphasis as you're reading this, look at these middle pages. You know, two master storytellers, that center panel is often, it's the center of the page. Like, everything's built around there. And there are several of these pages as we go through where that's the pivot. You know, like, that's the important moment, important image, the takeaway. And for several pages, it was Polly.
Right. Another important piece that they play around with storytelling-wise in this chapter is panel one of these pages. The time zone, basically, mm-hmm. and the calendar date will be seen in various ways, usually with this little day calendar that you rip off, you know, as the days go by. Sometimes it'll be a newspaper where we see the progression of the day.
I have a note here for page six where they talk about whoever did these crimes. It's almost like surgery.
Right.
In terms of precision, you know, like organs are being removed and and there aren't extra cuts. You know, like whoever's pulling those organs out knows where to find them and is making one cut and pulling them out. This story reminds me of surgery because there are so many details and they just weave together. It's immaculate. Like, again, on the reread, like, this thing is singing to me. You know, the stuff that I would have glossed over the first time, right, or didn't register, or I didn't realize, make note of this. On the reread, it is just a revelation of, like, one thing after another of all these pieces. This is a 5,000-piece puzzle that's being put together here, not a 500-piece.
Right. Look at this kind of thing. It's like the fade-out panel.
Eddie Campbell does this kind of stuff again and again where he's like trying different kinds of drawing styles for different narrative purposes. That's a good example. And there are quite a few of them that we're going to see. It really is kind of a masterclass. I don't, you know, that's the way to think of it. This is graduate school level comics making here. Like, don't try this for your first comic. Don't look at this as a how-to for to try to make a comic when you're beginning. But man, 20 years in, you look at this and it is just... It's masterpiece. It's these are master craftsmen, really top of their game.
Right. There's Polly again, man. We gotta take a look at the bod. And then there's that like real gross guy who's like talking to the dead. I think it's her husband, like talking to the dead body. Like, I forgive you for all the things you've done to me.
I'm glad you say that, Ed. I that stands out to me.
Yeah.
It points to the gender issues that come up again and again in this story. It points to the class issues and what a dick that husband is.
Yeah.
You know, like, this woman has just had years of her horrible living and he's forgiving her on her after being cut apart by some butcher.
Yeah. And with the inspector there, that has to make your spidey sense tingle a little bit when you have somebody who's like lacks that kind of compassion. First panel there, you get to see another treatment of letting us know what calendar day it is. Leather Apron becomes a name out of thin air that people hear again and again as being associated with the last seen person with Polly or whatever. But is his name Abernathy?
Aberline?
Aberline, that's it. Yeah. He's suspicious of that, but wants to break the monotony of the day up. And of course, a proper Englishman would never be able to be so vulgar.
You know what? This is the surgery part, and that's exactly what he's describing. So he goes through some of these other like murders that they're trying to figure out any connection, any find any of these suspects like your Leather Aprons. And he says Smith was raped and tortured. That's cruelty. I can understand cruelty.
Right.
Tabram was killed by frenzied and repeated stabbing. That's rage. I understand that too. This one's more methodical. Someone near enough did surgery on this woman. I don't understand that at all.
Yeah.
This is serial killer shit too. You know, like this is the stuff of, I don't understand what this is.
Right.
This defies typical human response.
Yeah. And how funny it is that it'll be 60 years later when the idea of like profiling these people is even considered, because when it was being done, it was still being shit on. You know what I mean? Like, we kind of accept it now, 100 years after this.
Yeah, it'd be impossible. Like, even the idea, nobody even has that idea. Like, he's just racking his brain trying to figure this out. And the benefit of this is written 100 years later,
right,
whenever we do understand profiling and stuff. But yeah, that would have been incredible to propose something like that.
So once again, man, it couldn't have been a proper Englishman who did this, but there's Buffalo Bill Cody's in town.
This is a really, I enjoyed this sequence a lot going back through this. Some of the stuff that so Buffalo Bill Cody would be like the Wild West traveling show.
Yeah.
He'd be like, we're going to go to England. We're going to have Native Americans. We're going to have cowboys and shooting and horseback riding. Wild, Wild West.
Yeah.
Put it on a show. And so that's what this is. These are outsiders that happen to be in town. So we don't think an Englishman could do this kind of dastardly deed. Let's go interview the outsiders. And it's really interesting because it gives more a chance to have the showmanship kind of idea put out there. You know, these guys are put on a show, or like, give them illusion, not realism. Talks about America is selling bullshit. And, you know, that's what people want. It feels like fake news. It goes into the fake journalism that's going to happen.
Right.
One of the threads that come out of this. But it's really interesting, this idea of like storytelling and selling storytelling to the public.
Right.
Really great stuff.
Kayfabe, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And again, this is probably the benefit of being written 100 years later.
Sure.
But it's really fun to read it and think about the influence that this kind of stuff has on how we perceive the world and reality. And it's pretty heated. You know, like, these are two different...
The Americans are like, you know, take a fucking... Like, we're out, man. We know our rights.
This guy is reading this book that's like prophecies, and it's prophesying the rise of America as a superpower.
Right.
And of course, Aberline's like, what are you talking about? What are you guys going to be? Superpower.
Yeah. And there's going to be war with Germany. The Queen's Germany. Us fight the Queen's Germany. What are you talking about?
Yeah. It's wild. This scene. Very fun. Very odd.
Yeah. And at the beginning of the chapter, you have the damn, birth of Adolf Hitler.
This is the this is another in my notes where I reference The Wire. It is just like seeing like every single connective thread possible that can go in here.
Right.
And then where do you get to play as a storyteller? And, you know, I think Alan Moore has some fun with this scene. Some fun reading it.
One of the next places we're going to be going to, like you said, man, the yellow journalism of creating news. So we're going to tell you what day it is by way of the newspaper headline.
Yeah, this is a great scene. This is where a crowd gathers at where the body was found.
Yeah, rubbernecking, like...
pictures? Selfies.
Posing, like, hey, look, I'm Leather Apron, and we're walking around like a ghoul.
Yeah, and also, this part, 100% spot on with human behavior, right?
Absolutely. People taking selfies at Ground Zero after 9/11. But this is 9/6. We're going to be putting this lady in the ground now. Following the whole trajectory of like her death and all the posthumous stuff that comes along with death. We get to see the Peckerwood husband again. Is he a suspect? Nah, he's a crass. He's gross, but he's a bitch. He didn't kill anybody. And the days are just going by, man. And Aberline is getting nowhere fast.
Yeah, and he's fully back in Whitechapel now.
And not happy about it.
No, they go through and describe, like, this is a description of Whitechapel and what it was like at the time. It sounds like hell.
Yeah.
You know, he describes at one point, like, 9-year-old kids having, brother and sister having sex in the open streets. There's no lodging, like, almost everybody there is kind of homeless.
Yeah.
It is just really, really dark. Like, this is a place, this is the worst of the worst. Like, and it makes it feel that way. You know, Moore does a really good job establishing that setting as just being awful. And then I love this drawing because you have a very sharp in-focus Aberline as he's entering this bar, and the inside's just this impressionistic drawing that to me is like, oh, everybody's a little out of it. They're a little bit drunk. It's almost like looking into the bar, you see the drunkenness.
Right.
And it contrasts in the same panel with the sobriety of outside of the bar.
Crazy bar setting. We got our Aberline. He's bumped into one of the future dead prostitutes, and he's got to kayfabe his way into a conversation with her. Almost screws up, man. Talks about, you know, says he's like a leathersmith or something, and he's working on, oh, it's this case I'm working on. Oh, what kind of case?
Yeah.
Saddle. It's one of those good human moments, man.
I love that police newspaper that they end the page on. If you look in the appendix, he says that's, you know, that's based on the actual newspaper. So it's kind of cool to think of how visual those newspapers would have been at the time. Probably
like
for
comics.
For mostly illiterate populace, right?
Right. And then it turns to leaves. Fall setting, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Torn All envelope, right. Man. Chapter 7. This is, here goes a bunch of the players involved. We got the dude that was with the prince sitting there amongst his paintings, all salty.
The guy who really set this whole thing in motion.
Yeah. We got Gaul. We have newspaper dudes.
Leather apron.
Look, this could be like the, you know, these are the ancestors to the Watchmen gossip news magazine people.
It's amazing to think of him as the ancestors, but the books created afterwards. So really the Watchmen dudes from 1986 are the ancestors.
Right.
This is the proposed leather apron guy.
And he's freaked out. He's holed up.
Oh, yeah. He's scared.
Yeah. So we get a little bit with all of them, man. There's a prostitutes getting together. They know that their homegirl is toast. One of the more like homely of the prostitutes, the more rotund one, Zoftig, if you will, she invites herself along to this to the bar to hang out with some dude that was gonna make time with the other prostitute girl, and they start a whole schmoz, which basically it's, we need to separate the girls, and we need our girl to kind of be on her own.
Yeah, and it continues that thing of just the lack of compassion that exists in these characters' lives. You know, even against each other, it's like dog eat dog, and
right,
the oddness of the drawing in that panel.
Yeah.
Very, very, I don't know the narrative reason for it, but it's another example of Eddie Campbell experimenting, or at least, you know, a panel that's kind of atypical for the rest of the book.
Right. Oh, yeah, and those girls, like, what were they fighting over, like, at the very beginning? A fucking piece of soap.
Yeah. Yeah, well, one says the other one robbed, pickpocketed a guy.
Yeah, but even before, like, what got them
yeah,
to
it
the
is.
Bar,
yeah, it
it's
is.
Like they have to negotiate for a piece of soap, and the girl's like, well, you know what, you better give it back to me.
Yes.
After.
What a horrible, like, it's such a depressing existence.
Let's
because
to
her one job is cleaning this guy, this
right.
pensioner.
Yeah. And really, that's just, you know, that's that Japanese soap land shit where it's not about cleaning anything. It's about fucking
yeah, it's
jerking,
it's about this.
Jerking the dude off. Look at this. After that chapter we read about, you know, like the 12-year-olds getting married and stuff, you see this, like, these little kids that are like a couple. Wow, man, look at that tree.
It's great drawing. It's really cool how it breaks that, the panel grid, too.
Yeah.
It breaks the panel grid, and all you hear see is Annie, who is going to be the victim in this chapter.
Yes.
And it looks like that's photocopied, maybe.
It does. It's hard to tell.
Although distorted. Yeah, it is hard to tell. I don't know for sure that that's a photocopy, but it wouldn't surprise me just based on how experimental a lot of this artwork is.
Yeah. These are the newspaper guys who are conjuring up some kayfabe to try to sell more papers.
Yeah, this is a great, this is really reminds me of Wire season 5, where they talk about, you know, we sold a bunch of papers off of, I don't know if it was Leather Apron or a different one, but basically giving a name to whatever this killer is. That's how you sell papers. Get a character on that front page.
Right.
And so their plan is to write a letter.
If it bleeds, it leads. Annie's been pretty bad, man. She's hasn't been indoors all day. She's a walk-in zombie. She's sick.
Can't afford food.
Yeah, hasn't eaten for a couple of days. A girl gives her a couple shillings or pence or whatever they call them shits. And under the express purposes of not using it for alcohol. couple of pages with our proposed leather apron guy who's shitting his pants, waiting for the popos to show up.
Yeah, there's a cop that has him sort of. That's who the cop thinks it is, and that cop, what's his name, Upright Jack, I think.
Right.
And they speculate on whether that's earned or because it's ironic, but either way, like, he's known for bringing in his suspects and getting confessions. You can imagine what that looks like in a Whitechapel dungeon cell.
And I think at some point the newspaper even like names the guy before it's officially supposed to be named, so he's holed up just biding his time.
Love this drawing too. Really beautiful lines.
This is, you know,
it's fog is setting in there late at night.
Death rides a pale horse everywhere except Whitechapel, because death rides a fucking black carriage with little Netley sitting at the top. When you see that, somebody's not long for this world. A lot of penmanship on this. A lot of pen strokes on this spread here, man.
Yeah, I like whenever Campbell does stuff like this where he's bending his lines. It really feels like light radiating out.
Mm.
You know, you see it again here. I don't know, something about it's just very effective to me in terms of having that almost light going out into the night.
Look at these little desperate hands showing up, man. And this would be that house where it's like, give me my four pennies so that you could just have a place to stay indoors for the night.
Yeah, and she's there just begging, let me sit here for a little bit.
Yeah, and he's like, I don't want to hear you even breathing.
This is a neat transition. So remember this this last panel whenever we flip the page to the next start. You know, it's almost the same shape and everything.
Right.
The coins being the eyes.
She overstayed her welcome, man. She stayed in there too long, so she has to bounce. She has to get the hell out. And she bumps directly into Netley, who is the answer to all of her problems. I have this rich guy who's been keeping his eye on you, and he's doing so well that he even can afford grapes, which of course are roofied up. Here's another instance where Gull, where you could probably guess the Alan Moore invention.
Yes and no. There's two stuff. So if you read the appendix for this, mm-hmm. the story is the people that live in this apartment would report these ghost-like visions of a couple walking by the window. Decades into the future,
sure.
You know? And so Alan Moore spins that around and makes those ghosts be Gull and Annie Chapman walking by. And so we see from the ghost or from these, you know, like the ghost, you know, point of view of Gull looking in.
Right.
And, you know, he plants the idea of Gull having these visions of God and things early on and talking about different visions. So it kind of makes sense that Gull is experiencing these like really strange moments.
Yeah.
And it's kind of neat that it's based on a ghost story.
Right.
It's just he's now taking the ghost point of view.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That is super cool, man.
And it's another one of those details. Like, how's he even find that information?
Just one sentence in one book, probably. I remember I forget who the author was that came to town, but they were promoting their latest book. And at the talk that they were giving, they said they read, like, you know, six books, you know, thousands of pages of stuff. And what ultimately ended up in the book was like three pages of material from like all this shit that they absorbed. But it creates a richness.
I made that comment, I think it was on our last From Hell video, about the documentary filmmaker that would shoot 100 hours and end up with 90 minutes. And somebody's like, that's nothing. Some of these documentary filmmakers shoot thousands of hours and end up with the 90 minutes. So it is true, you know, and I'm sure Alan Moore went through thousands of pages to get to this point.
And this point is the end of Annie. You know, she's done. Does he take her? He takes her wedding ring. What a vicious bastard.
Yeah, it's some of those little things, I think, is what Alan Moore has to make work. You know,
right.
Like there'll be a record of there was a ring on her finger, there were abrasions like it was taken off,
or yeah.
There were pennies, you know, at her feet. You know, like these little details that are kind of odd. And so sometimes I think those are moments with Gull that are a little bit weird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he might explain them as like almost divine, or, you know, why are you laying that stuff out?
Right.
The reason is because 100 years later, there's a record of that stuff being laid out.
Yeah. And all the stuff with the guts on the shoulder and all that, how it points to certain Masonic rituals and junk.
It is great, though. You know, you see a couple of people come out of this building and walk by, or then they find the body. It's neat how that stuff there are records of, like
right.
Who sees what and when.
Yeah, and the amount of people that are there. And also, narratively, he adds a piece about it's the case is being stepped on. The evidence is getting fucked with, and people are being made aware of it. Like, civilians are coming into the scene and taking souvenirs and picking stuff up. And
this particular one, if you read the appendix of it, grape skins were found in this alleyway. You know, so like, great detail. Great detail. I mean, those grapes, we see that every time with Gall.
Right.
Apparently there were some found that were, you know, written about in the evidence for the case.
Did you read anything about that laudanum stuff being found in the girl's body? But as I say that, it makes me wonder, like, how intricate were autopsies back then? Like, could they run those kind of tests?
Yeah, I don't remember reading that, but also there's a lot to read here.
Yeah.
You know, I bet you could reread this book your whole life and continue to find details.
Right.
So I'm certainly not an expert at this work.
And this kind of thing is like, you know, done over a decade's worth of time. It has to be done. Even if Eddie Campbell could draw 500 pages in 500 days, the amount of stuff put in here, you need a lot of time.
This is the cops, Aberline, you know, asking if you believe this leather apron thing. And he's like, Thick, the name of the cop. He gets results.
Right.
Yeah, maybe. He's not busting Jack the Ripper, but bring in the poor guy that he thinks is guilty and I guess beat him around a little bit. See if you can get a confession out of him.
Yeah, man, it'll, you know, make the day go by easier. Like, you'll have a cleared case.
And Aberline dresses him down. Johnny Upright is what that cop's known as. And he really, that whole page is him just dressing him down like, you're out. Don't let me hear your name and see your name in the newspapers again.
Continuing the whole thing of just an impossible situation for this Aberline guy. And, you know, he's our protagonist in a story. He's our hero of this story. And we know that he's going to fail. So it's like you stack the chips against the guy so that it makes the failure a little more acceptable or something.
It adds to the dread.
Yeah.
Because we see him as an old man still regretting this case.
Right.
We hear about him working for 15 years to get out of Whitechapel, and then he's put back in, and we know the outcome is terrible for him.
Yeah.
He lives with it the rest of his life. It's just one more dreadful element of this whole dreadful story.
And every other page, there's another sequence, another part of the conspiracy. And sometimes, like, you know, when it's the news guys, the conspiracy, they're involved in their own conspiracy. So there are conflicting conspiracies involved in this thing to just create confusion. And then Gall has his own extra bit of conspiracy that he's going to, like, try to weave into the thing. So there's, like, three separate strands sending this guy on all these different directions, and that's just frankly a waste of time.
Yeah, you have to wonder, like, this probably happens all the time when somebody's trying to, you know, a journalist or a detective investigating anything is trying to get to the case, even if it's well-intentioned. Just
yeah.
All the chaotic noise and information and everybody trying to be helpful, even if it's well-intentioned, it still just messes up. You know, it still just adds cloudiness and information that's not useful or maybe not accurate to these kinds of investigations. Like, even if you're doing your best, it's still not necessarily going to work out that way. And certainly in this case, it's not everybody trying to do their best. Those journalists are trying to sell papers. Like, they say, we need a villain, you know, like, it has nothing to do with helping the poor detective.
So let's throw another monkey wrench into the whole system and introduce a second lady named Mary Kelly.
Yeah, this part, we mentioned in the first four chapters at times being confused by characters. This sequence confused me quite a bit. This is a...
Because these are new characters out of left field,
right? And again, you know, they're here because it's based on real people that were involved, but it's a little bit confusing as a reader.
It makes me wonder if these are discoveries that Alan Moore made around, like, years...
Partway through the
exactly.
writing.
Because, you know, if he had it to do over again, he would build them in earlier... You know, let's just throw more confusion at Aberline. And this time, the confusion, it's even going to touch Sir William Gall a little bit.
Yeah, and real quick, we see the two surviving prostitutes kind of crying about, they still think it's the local gang
the Nichols
that is extorting
mob.
Them, and they need a lot more money than they can scrape together. It's why they started the blackmail plot, was to get that money to pay off the gang for protection. So they're under the impression that local gang is now is killing them.
Yeah. Like
they're not getting their money soon enough, and two of their friends are now dead.
And they are going to do everything they can to get that cash, to just like end this misery. That's their motivation for this issue.
By the way, when you're a new character, a new poor woman in this setting, and you're introduced in this book, it's not good.
No.
You're not here to solve the case.
Oh, no. No. Cut to the prince, who knows that this bloodshed is being done in his name, and he's a gay guy? He's like bisexual or something? Is that what we're dealing with right there?
I don't know. It feels like that's the implication of this scene, but my takeaway is it's this guy who married a woman, had a kid, was pulled away by his grandmother, and doesn't care at all about the kid or the woman he married.
Right. Yeah, just a little Lord Fauntleroy.
Just deadbeat dad. Totally narcissistic, you know. He's worried about him and his relationship with this guy who refers to the queen as grandmother, and is like, there's a note here, or I think the prince says that it's like, you could be killed for that.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Don't call her that.
we still hang commoners for calling her grandmother.
Commoners. I like these kind of images. You know, like the street scenes, you know, like it's something that might just be a background of what's going on around town.
The perspective of this looks like it's traced from a photo, not the characters, but the background looks like it's got this like bubble lens.
It is weird.
Kind of
yeah.
image that's looks like it was taken from a weird lensed camera. Throughout the past couple of chapters, when we introduced Aberline, he would talk with Mary Kelly, right?
Yeah, one of the prostitutes. She calls herself Emma.
Right, but there was like the one girl who goes by two names, which creates the confusion.
Right. Yeah, I think I have a feeling a lot of these women may have used aliases.
Sure.
Because they do bounce around with names. Several of them, the characters in this book, bounce around with names.
Hey, man, the strippers at Club Erotica, her name ain't Cherry. You know what I'm saying? You're staying in the same town, man. You better fucking use a fresh name or else you're going to have a stalker or two. So the one prostitute, she's got major money troubles. Aberline is like the one good guy in her life. Cause he needs clues, and he's undercover here. He's not looking to trick. He gives her a couple dollars and she thanks him for it. Man, you didn't even try to fuck me, man. That's real cool of you. But then she kisses him and he's like, oh man, am I going to have to get tested? No?
I was thinking he was falling for her, but yeah, okay.
I was thinking like, oh man, do I got a bump on my lip now? How long does it take for them to come up?
This is a pretty fun sequence. This is Aberline going through the suspects and trying to figure out what works and doesn't. And he has two suspects and neither one of them are any good. And he knows it.
Bullocks to one and, fuck Lieutenant Thick or whatever his name is. So he's got to go back out on the streets, go back home.
See, this is the moment why I was thinking he's falling for this.
Yeah.
Because when he's home with his wife, she's being real nice to him. Because he was saying the name Emma the night before in his sleep. Is his wife's name Emma? Like,
I guess
man,
so.
I don't know if my wife would appreciate me calling out some other woman's name while I'm sleeping.
Sure, yeah. It must be. We got Netley getting caught in his feelings a little bit. There's a famous Robert Crumb strip called Bobo Bolinsky where it just shows the same character in like five different angles. And to me, this is like a version of Bobo Bolinsky. Just see him in a bunch of different angles, but he's obviously in a little bit of turmoil, but not so much that he still can't help Uncle William Gall out, but he's got to get a little bit sauce to do so.
Self-medicating.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's expressed his how difficult this is for him. Even talking about it in the beginning before any of it happened, he sort of had trouble with it.
Right. Look, we got some Mason imagery right there. And now this part confused me a little bit when Gull meets with these dudes and they're like, you know, we got orders for you to stop the murders, blah, blah, blah. And Gull is like, so this is sent after the first killing, but you say murders? Like, so
yeah, he decides the note's bullshit.
Right.
Which I guess it is.
Yeah.
You know, this police commissioner is really not... This sucks. You know, these are the worst murders in Whitechapel, London history or whatever. And according to this story, this police commissioner knows who's doing it. You know, like he's trying to just like, come on, please stop doing this.
Yeah. And it's so the commissioner knows, but so do some like straight up bobbies. Like we'll see those moments play out here in a little bit as well.
Well, yeah, we will. I don't know if they know exactly what is going on or who's doing it. They just get little bits of orders. So one of the orders that Gall leaves here is like, if Marie C Kelly's crosses your path, any of your policemen, let me know about it.
Right.
And so they have those orders, but maybe not necessarily knowing why
Yeah.
somebody's looking for her.
That's fair. These backgrounds, ridiculous.
It's beautiful. All the drawings are just stunning. Yeah, the throwaway kind of backgrounds, you know, little signage, the bricks, the alleys, the streets, the cobblestone streets. It's all just amazing.
So Aberline gave our girl enough money, more than enough money, that should satisfy that Nichols mob, the people that she suspects as killing her homies. So she meets up with them, and once again, man, the lack of streetwise in these prostitutes. Like nowadays, man, chicks are much hipper. She makes sure that these are the Nichols guys, and they're like, yeah, sure. She gives them the loot that she got, and they're like, huh, what? And it becomes very clear. They tell her that, oh yeah, they're not the ones. We didn't do those ladies in. Those ones, meaning that they definitely have done similar things in the past. And she is fully desperate now. She got rid of her money. She thought that this was gonna solve all her problems. She's back at square one, and she doesn't even have the loot to stay at the little Doss house.
Great moment.
Yeah.
Because this is her hopes of survival are gone. She is as clueless now as most of the as the police, you know, as the detective in terms of like, what do you mean it's not you?
Right.
I have no other leads. There's a psycho killing my friends.
Yep. And really sold well in that last panel with just a black abyss, her in outer space.
Yeah, what's more hopeless than just a tear of black ink?
Yep. Fucking Netley, man, comes across.
So a couple pages ago, we see a couple of policemen, telephone, telegraph, telepolicemen,
Right.
whispering to each other in there, and you know, passing through basically that we've gotten this woman whose name we were told to look for. She's in Drunk Tank,
Right.
and so that part is starting. That network of information is starting from the police. This is one of the original prostitutes. This
Yes.
is Liz, so she's on the list. Unfortunate for her. And I think this is the one that he says, wait for an hour. I'm gonna go get my master who's been looking for you.
Yeah. And you know what? He's a rich ass dude. Like, here, man, I'm gonna buy a half a pound of grapes and I'm gonna let you get a couple.
And now, as if all the great art that we've seen so far isn't enough, it's raining. So now we get to see like the wheels going through the wet streets and splashes and stuff. Eddie's getting bored and just showing off now.
But you know how it goes, man. Alamore read it rained
I was going to say, he probably
that
does know
night.
exactly what the weather was whenever this second body or third body is found.
I consulted a Poor Richard's Almanac from 1899. Have some Marxists talking some shit, because Alamore probably read that there was a Marxist meeting. The first witnesses of the dead body were probably Marxists.
Some connection to the whole class stuff that's, you know, a big part of this book. It's just connecting as many of these dots as you can.
The murders are getting more and more kind of careless, more.
Pressure's mounting.
Right. But also Gall is like, he's enjoying it to the point where he's like losing his logical part of his mind. It's like psychosexual or something at this point, man. The dude is like fucking into it.
And by the way, his prey is looking for it too. You know, you give off the wrong vibe and these women are on edge, you know,
Right.
now that it's happened to a couple of their friends, like they're out of their minds with paranoia.
Right.
You know, if that grape doesn't taste right, what are you feeding me, dude?
Yeah. Look at Gull just lunging.
Yeah. Netley helping out. This is
Brutal stuff.
It is.
Brutal, brutal. Tim Vigil, Black Blood.
Very dark, and as he gets away, knife still in hand, the cops find him.
Right.
Say, I've been looking for you because are you looking for this lady?
Yeah. But then to throw one more chink in the armor, one more set of obfuscation to who possibly did this. This building contains like a Jewish shop or something. And he's going to write, you know, the Jews are the men who will not be blamed for nothing. Whatever that means. And he spells it incorrectly on purpose.
Yeah, which is a Masonic spelling. However, we don't know that he wrote this. This is one of the bigger things that Alan Moore sort of... What we know is this was found written next to that bloody rag.
Right.
It's speculative on Moore's part that this was written to kind of just add to the chaos, to the noise of all of this.
How about this piece here? It feels very like incongruous to all the art we've seen for about 250 pages. He's laying down some Zipitone and has entered Guy Davis Baker Street.
Yes.
Kind of line art. It's so different.
It is. I agree. I don't know what the intent is there. You know, I'm not sure.
But
maybe
then he's
the
also...
grayness is because, by the way, the character we see there, that's the prostitute Gaul was after.
Right.
He picked the wrong person because of the name confusion from the police, you know. But the woman that he killed is not the woman he was after.
Yeah.
And he laments that it's a shame there were only four of them. Five would have had a lot more power if there were five.
Right.
Mary Kelly comes home. You know, despite being a prostitute, like she does have sort of this common law husband, but he did hear that. Like he heard Liz was killed, which was true, and he heard Mary Kelly was killed. And I mean, like this, everybody's obsessed with this. This is your front page of the newspaper, so everyone's aware of this happening, and that's what he heard. And so when she comes home, it's relief for both of them, but then terror for her because she hadn't heard this and that her name was used. Like this is bad stuff. You have to leave.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, they have to get out.
I guess
it's just not an option, but...
Yeah, man, there's...
If you're her, you know you're done. At this point, like, all of my friends have been killed. Somebody was killed with my name. Never use your name again. Like, change your name
to
this page.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell your husband not to call you that. That's not your name anymore. Because somebody's after you.
Amazing panel here, because...
Yeah.
This is not comforting. Those are not comforting looking hands. They're big, ominous looking hands. Even though it's her husband, that's a scary image.
The hands are great throughout this.
That's
everything,
true.
You know, Campbell's great, but there's so much emphasis on hands from the surgeon, you know, cutting people up to this kind of stuff. It's really brutal, but beautiful. The hatching on the clothes instead of the outside.
Boom. Four more chapters down, Jimmy, and we got three dead prostitutes and one poor lady who had... similar name to another prostitute. Still going to go downhill from here.
It's weird this is halfway point.
Yeah.
You know, almost everybody's collected now. So what do we have coming up in eight more chapters? Tune in, find out.
It's been a while since I read, so I'm curious myself. Jimmy, let's bounce, dude. Got more comics to read. Kayfabers, like, follow, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Hit the bell. We'll notify you when the next vids are available. Octobriana's in stores right now. Selling out quick, man, so get it while it's hot. If you see it, scoop it up, because it's going to be worth $500 next time you see it. Red Room, my current comics project, is being serialized right now on Patreon for the early adopter. Patreon.com/Ed Piskor. $3 gets you the archive. About 5 dozen strips up there right now as of this recording, and I put new ones up there every Tuesday.
And again, if you're enjoying From Hell coverage and you made it this far into the video, you will love Red Room. I don't know about surgical precision, but there's definitely disembowelments. You can subscribe to the Cartoonist Kayfabe e-newsletter at the links below this video to keep up with everything we're doing. You can find Cartoonist Kayfabe t-shirts and merchandise at the links below this video.
Jimmy, give them the marching orders, man. We got some From Hell to read.
Read more comics.